Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I would like to start today's program with a quote from a late 19th century Belgian priest, Adolf Daens, who was also a member of Belgium's parliament in the late 19th century, a vigorous advocate of the poor and labor rights, who opposed Belgium's King Leopold's enslavement and mass genocide of the Belgian Congo. Quote, "Remember that you have only one enemy, those who exploit you. And remember, you have only one ally, those who suffer beside you and with you." I start with an article from The Guardian. Is there any legal justification for the U.S. attack on Venezuela? By Geraldine McKelvey. Donald Trump said on Saturday morning that U.S. troops had carried out a, quote, large-scale strike, unquote, on Venezuela and captured its president, Nicolas Maduro, and his wife, Celia Flores. The couple has been indicted in New York on terrorism and drug charges. Trump has accused Maduro of running a narco-terrorist organization, quote, unquote. However, the legality of the operation has been called into question, with even some of Trump's allies suggesting it violated international law. The Guardian newspaper spoke to leading experts in the field of international law to ask for their view on the unfolding events in Venezuela. Question. Is the U.S. operation in Venezuela justified under international law? The experts The Guardian spoke to agreed that the United States is likely to have violated the terms of the United Nations Charter, which was signed in October 1945 and designed to prevent another conflict on the scale of the Second World War. A central provision of this agreement, known as Article 2, Section 4, rules that states must refrain from using military force against other countries and must respect their sovereignty. Joffrey Robertson's a founding head of Doughty Street Chambers and a former president of the United Nations War Crimes Court in Sierra Leone, said the attack on Venezuela was contrary to Article 2, Section 4 of the Charter. The reality is that America is in breach of the United Nations Charter, he added. It has committed the crime of aggression, which the court at Nuremberg described as the supreme crime. It's the worst crime of all. Elvira Dominguez Redondo, a professor of international law at Kingston's University, described the operation as a, quote, crime of aggression and unlawful use of force against another country, unquote. Susan Brew, professor of international law and a senior associate research fellow at the Institute of Advanced Legal Studies, agreed that the attack could have only been considered lawful if the United States had a resolution from the United Nations Security Council or was acting in self-defense. There is just no evidence whatsoever on either of those fronts, Bruce said. How is the United States likely to defend its actions? The U.S. may try to argue that it attacked Venezuela in self-defense to counter the alleged threat from the narco-terrorist organization, quote unquote, it accuses Maduro of leading. Both the UN Charter and its own domestic laws make some provisions for the use of military force in self-defense. However, Robertson said, there is no conceivable way America can claim although no doubt it will, that the action was taken in self-defense. If you are going to use self-defense, you have to have a real and honest belief that you are about to be attacked by force. No one has suggested that the Venezuelan army is about to attack the United States. The idea that Maduro is some sort of drug supremo cannot prevail against the rule that invasion for the sake of regime change is unlawful. You would have to prove those drug traffickers were threatening the sovereignty of the United States, Brew added. The United States is going to argue vigorously that drug trafficking is a scourge and it's killing many people, and I agree. But a lot of international law experts have been looking at this, and there was not even clear evidence that those drug traffickers were from Venezuela, let alone that they were governed by Maduro in any sense, quote unquote. What sanctions could the United States face for its actions? The United Nations Security Council can impose sanctions on countries in an attempt to maintain peace. These can include trade restrictions, arms embargoes, and travel bans. However, five members of the Council, the United States, China, Russia, the United Kingdom, and France, have a veto on this, meaning any action taken against the United States is unlikely to come into force. Sanctions have to be imposed by the Security Council, and America is a member with a veto, Robertson said. This is important because it shows the Security Council is a worthless body. A country which breaks international law can avoid condemnation simply by vetoing it. The only body that can act will be eviscerated by the American veto, quote unquote. Dominguez Redondo described the situation as impossible. If the Security Council cannot decide on sanctions, the countries can choose whether or not to follow them, she said. Because the United States has veto power, the sanctions are never going to be decided there. What precedent could this set globally? If the U.S. faces no consequences for the invasion of Venezuela, experts believe it could embolden other countries to carry out operations which may contravene international law. The most obvious consequence is that China will take the opportunity to invade Taiwan, Robertson said. This is the most appropriate time for it to do so, bolstered by the precedent of Trump's invasion of Venezuela and, of course, his appeasement of Russia in its invasion of Ukraine. In fact, I would say that Trump's invasion of Venezuela is the crime of aggression, the same crime Putin has committed by invading Ukraine. Dominguez Redondo added that it could further weaken the United Nations Security Council. The Security Council was the prevention mechanism for the Third World War, she said. This has been completely dismantled, mainly by the United States, but also by the United Kingdom, when they went to war without authorization in Iraq. The Security Council has been eroded. Where does Trump's attack leave U.S. allies? The United Kingdom Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, has said he wants to speak to Trump and other allies to establish the facts of the Venezuela operation, but stressed that the UK was not involved in the invasion and has said he believes, quote, we should all uphold international law, unquote. Other NATO member states will also be closely observing how events unfold. The United Kingdom, as the guardian of the Nuremberg Principles, has a duty to condemn the United States for this breach of international law, Robertson said. I would say that leaders who start wars are responsible for the death and destruction that comes in their wake. there is a responsibility on Keir Starmer, who has played a straight bat so far, and rightly hasn't commented when the facts are not known fully. But it is likely this duty will devolve on him to stand up for the Nuremberg principles, to condemn Trump for his breach of them by committing the crime of aggression, and lead the free world in trying to moderate consequences. And that was from The Guardian. Is there any legal justification for the United States attack on Venezuela? And also now from The Guardian, Trump's new world order is being born, and Venezuela is just the start. And that's by Owen Jones. The U.S. president has been quite clear that Cuba, Mexico, Colombia, and Greenland are in his sights. We must believe him. As Venezuela's skyline lit up under U.S. bombs, we were watching the morbid symptoms of a declining empire. That may sound counterintuitive. Surely this looks like decay, then intoxication, a superpower high on its own force. But Trump's great virtue, if it can be called that, is candor. Previous U.S. presidents draped naked self-interest in the language of democracy and human rights. Trump dispenses with the costume. In 2023, he boasted, "When I left, Venezuela was ready to collapse. We would have it taken over. We would have gotten all that oil. It would have been right next door," quote unquote. And this was no off-the-cuff remark. The logic of an oil grab and much more besides is laid out plainly in Trump's recently published national security document. The document accepts something long denied in Washington, that U.S. global hegemony is over. After the end of the Cold War, American foreign policy elites convinced themselves that permanent American domination of the entire world was in the best interest of our country, quote unquote. It declares with barely concealed contempt. The days of the United States propping up the entire world order like Atlas are over, again a quote. These are the strategies and ceremonious funeral rites for U.S. superpower status. What replaces it is a world of rival empires, each enforcing its own sphere of influence. And for the U.S., that sphere is the Americas. After years of neglect, the strategy pronounces, the United States will reassert and enforce the Monroe Doctrine to restore American preeminence in the Western Hemisphere, quote unquote. The Monroe Doctrine, formulated in the early 19th century, purported to block European colonialism. In practice, it laid the foundations for U.S. domination over its Latin American backyard. Violence in Latin America facilitated by Washington is hardly new. My parents took in refugees who had fled Chile's right-wing dictatorship, installed after the socialist president Salvador Allende was overthrown in a CIA-backed coup. I don't see why we need to stand by and watch a country go communist due to the irresponsibility of its people, declared the then U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. Similar logic underpinned U.S. support for murderous regimes in Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, and Bolivia, as well as across Central America and the Caribbean. But in the last three decades, that domination has been challenged. The so-called pink tide of progressive governments, spearheaded by Brazil's president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, sought to assert greater regional independence. And, crucially, China, the main U.S. rival, has grown in power across the continent. The two-way goods trade between China and Latin America was 259 times larger in 2023 than it was in 1990. China is now the continent's second largest trading partner, behind only the United States. At the end of the Cold War, it did not even make the top 10. Trump's assault on Venezuela is just the opening move in an attempt to reverse all of this. The experience of Trump's first term has led too many to conclude that the strong man in the White House was all bluster. Then he reached an accommodation with the traditional Republican elite. The unwritten bargain was simple: deliver tax cuts and deregulation, and he could vent endlessly on social media. Second term Trump is a full, fat, far-right regime. When he menaces the democratically elected presidents of Colombia and Mexico, believe him. When he declares with barely concealed relish that Cuba is ready to fall, believe him. And when he states, "We do need Greenland," absolutely believe him. He really does intend to annex more than 2 million square kilometers of European territory. If, when, Greenland is swallowed by a Trumpian empire, what then? Trump will have noted the pitifully weak European response to his brazenly legal assault on Venezuela. But a U.S. seizure of Danish sovereign territory would surely spell the end of NATO, founded on the principle of collective defense. Denmark's land would be stolen no less blatantly than Russia's devouring of Ukraine. Whatever muted noises have emerged from London, Paris, or Berlin, the Western alliance would be finished. When the Soviet Union collapsed, U.S. elites convinced themselves they were militarily invincible and that their economic model marked the endpoint of human development. That hubris led directly to catastrophe in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya, and the final crash of 2008. U.S. elites promised their people utopian dreams and then dragged them from one disaster to another. Trumpism itself emerged from the resulting mass disillusionment. But the America First, and that's a quote, response to United States decline is to abandon global dominance in favor of a hemispheric empire. What does that leave the United States itself? When the U.S. defeated Spain at the end of the 19th century and seized the Philippines, leading dignitaries founded the American Anti-Imperialist League. We hold that the policy known as imperialism is hostile to liberty and tend toward militarism, they declared, an evil which it has been our glory to be free. We assert that no nation can long endure half republic and half empire, the Democratic Party asserted in the 1900 presidential election. And we warn the American people that imperialism abroad will lead quickly and inevitably to despotism at home, quote, unquote. In the end, informal empire replaced direct colonialism, and American democracy, always deeply flawed, was injured. Who would dismiss such warnings as exaggeration now? What happens abroad cannot be divorced from what happens at home. This is the imperial boomerang, as the Martinician author Amy Cesar defined it three quarters of a century ago, analyzing how European colonialism returned to the continent in the form of fascism. We have already watched the war on terror boomerang in this way, its language and logic repurposed for domestic repression. The Democratic Party is not a political party, Stephen Miller, Trump's deputy chief of staff, declared last summer. It is a domestic extremist organization. National Guard troops are dispatched into Democrat-run cities like occupying forces, echoing the surges once unleashed on Afghanistan or Iraq. Seen this way, Trump's indulgence of Russian ambitions in Ukraine is hardly mysterious. Back in 2019, Russia reportedly proposed offering increased U.S. influence in Venezuela in exchange for the U.S. retreating from Ukraine. Who knows if such a deal has been made? What is certainly true is that a new world order is being born. It is one where increasingly authoritarian powers use brute force to subjugate their neighbors and steal their resources. The question is whether we have the means, willingness, and ability to fight back. Owen Jones, who wrote this story, is a Guardian columnist. His next book, The Fall of the West, will be published by Penguin Random House in autumn 2026. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is editor of this program. New York Times writer Michelle Goldberg ended an opinion piece concerning Donald Trump's most recent trial. Quote, whether Trump truly gets his comeuppance is up to the voters, not the jury.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.